Hello and welcome to Outside In. I'm John Burns and this is my podcast for people who like to be outdoors, but until fairly recently have had to stay indoors. As some of you may know, one of my interests has been trying to spot some of the iconic wildlife of the Highlands, and I've also purchased myself a camera trap, which allows me to try and photograph wildlife. So far, I've managed to photograph a roe deer and a mouse. So I'm not the most successful cameraman there is. But my guest today is Andy Howard, and he is a wildlife photographer and an author based up here in the Highlands. And I'm hoping that he'll be able to tell us a bit about his life, maybe some of the tricks he knows about photographing wildlife, and give us an insight into his work. Hello, Andy. How are you?
Hi, John. Thank you for having me. I'm very well, thank you. I've had a nice year off during lockdown, so I've called it a sabbatical.
Well, that's one way of looking at it, isn't it? So, you've just published a book on the secret life of the otter, and obviously before that you'd looked at the mountain hare and the secret life of the cairngorms, all of which sound to me like fairly challenging things to do. Well, what got you interested in wildlife photography at the outset?
Okay, we have to go back, you know, quite a few years. When I was 10 years old, I was moved up to the Highlands with my parents to Fortrose, and went to Fortrose Academy. And of course, we had the dolphins on our doorstep. And I used to cycle down from the house in the evening after school and after dinner, and I used to sit on the jetty at the end of Shannery Point and watch the dolphins. And then for my 16th birthday, I was asked what I wanted, you know, and I said I want money and I want to buy a camera. So everybody clubbed together, 10 quid here, 5 quid there, and ended up with a nice little pot of money. Hopped on the train one Saturday, went to Edinburgh and popped into Jessop's camera shop down there and put my money on the table and on the counter and said, I want a camera. And the guy went, well, what kind of camera do you want? And I went, I don't know, just a camera, one that you can screw the lenses off the front of it, you know, a good fancy camera. And ended up back on the train that evening with a Minolta X300, which is a fairly basic SLR camera. Mm-hmm. We're talking film cameras here, not digital.
Yeah, yeah.
And a lens. Didn't even know how to switch the thing on. Didn't know anything about f-stops or shutter speeds. And learned really from the school of hard knocks. And couldn't afford a lot of films. You know, back then, you're probably talking a fiver for a roll of film, plus processing. So it was quite an expensive thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And That was the seed planted into photography. And then there was a sort of natural progression in my enthusiasm and the equipment. And by the age of 21, sort of 5 years after getting my first camera, I'd progressed onto a pretty good Canon camera with a decent lens and was starting to get results with the dolphins. And it was the dolphins at Shannery Point that really started me off on this journey that we're on. Yeah.
And so, are you largely self-taught then, or did you do some training in photography?
100% self-taught. Never had a lesson really from anybody. Just really learn from my mistakes, which is a great way to learn. Actually, there was quite a gap after we get from about 25 years old until 2015, which is 45 years old. So it was about a 20-year gap where I did an awful lot of fly fishing for salmon and trout. Then I met my wife and she didn't like fishing. So we were getting married and she said, Andy, you know, this fishing thing, I'm not so keen on it. Even though I'd tried to butter it up a bit by taking her on nice picnics and bottles of wine by the river, it still didn't wash with her. So I said, well, what do you want to do? Let's get a hobby that we can both do. Do you want to buy a yacht? Do you want to, you know, buy a dinghy? Do you want to buy mountain bikes? Do you want to buy motorbikes? What do you want to do? Let's get a hobby that we can share. And she said, well, you know, photography, I quite fancy giving digital photography a go. And so we bought a cheap Canon, well, £350 Canon camera. I say cheap now. When you hear later on about the prices of some of the equipment we use, it's 350 quid is nothing nowadays. But anyway, from the moment, the first day I went out with that digital camera, I felt liberated that I didn't have to buy rolls of film, that I wasn't limited to 36 exposures. I could take hundreds of pictures a day. And it was like opening Pandora's box. Suddenly, you know, all these possibilities opened up, and it just completely rejuvenated my passion in wildlife photography. And I have to say, my wife is an excellent wildlife photographer in her own right. Lindsay has won awards. She's probably a more natural photographer than I am. She has a natural artistic ability, whereas I have to maybe think a little bit more about my pictures. But it just comes to her much more naturally. So, so that was it. Digital, the age of digital cameras and the technological revolution that came with it was really the instigator of igniting this passion again.
Right, and what got you involved with photographing otter? Because they can be a fairly tricky animal to photograph. And obviously, my own experience, I long ago abandoned the idea of photographing things. I decided that I just do not have the patience. But I was happy to try and spot things. And I spent a very cold few days on the West Coast searching for otter. And then I came back and didn't see any. And then I came back to Inverness and one popped its head out of the nest when I arrived home, which I thought was taking liberties a bit, really. So what fascinated you with photographing the otter?
Well, my first encounter with otters was when I was a young boy. My auntie and uncle bought a property and a bit of land on Mull in 1965. So, you know, I was born in 1970 and nearly, you know, a lot of my childhood holidays were spent on Mull. You know, myself, my brother and my cousins, we were feral. You know, we'd go out at first light or when we woke up, we'd come in for breakfast, we'd go out again until supper time or lunchtime, and we'd build dams in the streams. We had golden eagles nesting on our cliffs. And my cousin John, who I got on really well with, sadly he's no longer with us, he was quite a famous botanist in New Zealand. He's also written books as well on botany and campfire survival books and things like that. But anyway, I digress. So John and I remember one day we actually climbed down to a golden eagle nest and looked into the nest and stood there in awe looking at these huge eggs. I can't believe we did that now, you know. But, you know, our beach at the bottom of our little valley that we have, on Mull, we've got otters there, but it was on a camping trip to the Sound of Mull, just opposite Iona, that I had my first encounter with an otter when I'd gone off to the rocks for a comfort break as a wee boy, and this head appeared out of the rocks and just stared at me, and I thought, oh, it's a little dog. And you know, we made eye contact, and I went off back to the camp and met the family who were cooking burgers, whatever they were doing. And I said, oh, there's a dog on those rocks. And they went, what, a little dog? And I said, yeah, like a little sausage dog. And they went, oh, no, that'd be an otter. And I got confused. I was thinking, ostrich. Why would it be an ostrich? No, I'm saying it wasn't a bird. It was a dog. And so that was my first encounter. And then, when we got, you know, fast forwarding a long time now, in sort of about 2014, 2015, something like that. 2011, when I was getting into digital photography. You know, obviously a trip to Mull was a natural thing for me to do. And I went with a friend and we went to target otters, and on the last afternoon, it was pouring down, it was November. It was just a really dreary, dark day, typical West Highland November day. And we spotted this otter coming ashore with a scorpion fish, managed to get a couple of pictures. And then from there on, I was hooked. It was just, I have to photograph these animals. You know, as I did with the mountain hares, and I have a bit of an obsessive personality. If something really, you know, ignites a flame or passion within me, I will absolutely 100% go for it and commit to that. And you do need that when you're specializing in any particular species. Yeah.
Yeah. And also your other book, or one of your other books, is about the Cairngorms. What drew you to the Cairngorms? Because they're quite a harsh environment to be to be photographing things, I would have thought.
Yeah, well, I as I said earlier, I moved up to the Highlands at the age of 10, and my best friend in my school days, Simon, was a keen skier, and his family were skiers. And I got invited along at weekends, and we'd go down to Cairngorm and started skiing at about the age of 11 or 12. And I went all the way through sort of the progression of learning beginner, intermediate into advanced, did a little bit of racing, wasn't very good at it, but enjoyed it. And then did in the sort of 80s, when I'd left school, did a little bit of instructing, but managed to pick the two seasons where there was the least amount of snow in living memory,
yes.
which didn't bode very well. Luckily, I didn't have commitments, so it wasn't a big deal, really, that I wasn't earning any money at that time. It was more about living a lifestyle. So that introduced me to the Cairngorms and a passion for them. And occasionally we would see, you know, a ptarmigan flying over or a mountain hare running across the slopes if it'd been disturbed. And what happened was, when we had a dinner party in about 2014, and some friends were there, and one of the guys there, he is an advisor to the whiskey industry, and he said to me, Andy, to be good at anything, you need to specialize. You know, you can't just photograph every species. You know, you have to choose a handful and really hone in on those and spend as much time with those as you can. So I said, oh, I'm going to do that. Right. So he said, right, pick five species now. Let's do it now. So I said, right, mountain hare, ptarmigan, dotterel, black grouse, and try to remember what, red squirrel, something like that. Anyway. And I said, right, I'm going to photograph those five species for 5 years. And over those 5 years, I really just specialized in, ptarmigan was a fifth one. It wasn't red squirrel, it was ptarmigan. And the reason I chose those five species was I was sort of in my early 40s, and I thought going up into the mountains with heavy camera equipment isn't an easy thing to do. So let's get the difficult, hard physical species out of the way first, i.e. the species that live between 2,500 feet and 4,000 feet.
Right.
And really specialize in those while I'm still young and fit, and then work my way down to sea level. Well, I've just published a book on otters, which are at sea level. So I think that gives you an idea of how fast my career in altitude has descended to sea level. But no, all jokes aside, you know, I do still love going up into the mountains and spending time with the ptarmigan and mountain hares. So, that was the five species over 5 years. We're now sort of 10 or 12 years into this sort of career in wildlife photography, and we've crept up to about 12 species. So that's where we're at now.
One of my limited most of my attempts at photographing wildlife ended in failure so far. One of the things I did quite recently was I quite regularly visit this bothy on the west coast, and there was a barn next door to it, an ex-stable, and what I did was I built a barn owl nesting box, which is a massive thing, to be honest. If you're going to build nesting boxes, you know, it's like starting with the royal the royal box, you know. Me and a mate erected this box in the barn, and nothing happened for 2 years. And then I went back there quite recently, and there were owl pellets everywhere. I put my little camera, my trail camera trap up in this loft, and got nothing. but I'm keeping trying, you know.
The fact that you've got pellets there shows that there are that's the secret, is you've got to find a habitat And then you've got to work out what lives there. Trail cams are great because they are an extra set of eyes 24/7. And then once you know what species are there, it's how you approach, you know, to photograph them. So, you know, you're almost there. You know, you've got the box in place to attract them. The pellets are there, so you know they're there. So yeah, it will happen if you commit the time to it. Yeah.
Yes, yes, I'm sure you're right. I like the camera traps. I'm at the very early stages of learning to use camera traps. One of the things I find a bit tricky with them is you can't really look through the lens to see what you can see. And so quite a few times I was up in Sutherland and I took some cat food and left the cat, put my little camera trap on a post and put the cat food below it. And something came and ate the cat food. I suspect a stoat or something. But unfortunately for me, I had the camera too high and it was out of shot. So that was
another. Some of them have little LCD screens on, which are more expensive ones. So once you pay above about £150, £200, you get a little LCD display, and that really helps in that situation. But right. they're fairly wide-angle lenses. So
yeah,
about 10 meters away from your from the cat food, looking straight at it should do the trick.
Yeah. I was right on top of it. There's my mistake, you see.
Too close, yeah.
What would you advise for anybody today who was, you know, wanting to get into trying to photograph wildlife?
First and foremost is work local, and, you know, find what lives locally to you. If our listeners to this podcast live in an urban area, mm-hmm. parks are fantastic. When I lived in London, you know, my nanny and my mum used to take me to Hyde Park, and there's pictures of me as a little tot sitting on a bench with a grey squirrel on my knee and things like that. So, you know, if I lived in London, I'd be working the parks down there. I have actually photographed grey squirrels in Hyde Park on a trip that I had to London. I don't know why, but I took my big camera equipment with me and photographed parakeets and grey squirrels there.
Oh right,
and yeah, you can get great pictures in cities.
Do you have to spend a fortune on equipment these days?
Yes and no. The more you invest, as long as the camera is in the right hands, you have to learn how to use it. Mm-hmm. Once you've learned the basics, you can apply that to professional equipment and amateur equipment. The more you pay, the more technology you get, and the more you can rely on the camera to autofocus more correctly and things like that, your frame rate goes up to maybe 20 frames a second as opposed to 3 or 4. So you're timesing your chance of getting the picture 5 times if you're going from 4 frames a second to 20 frames a second.
Right.
So the more you pay, the better you become. Better the percentage of success should be if the camera's in the right hands. I guide for a lot of people, and I have had people that have rocked up with £40,000 worth of equipment and very little knowledge on how to use it. But then that's my job then, to coach them and to nurture them, get them set up, explain it in a really simplistic way, like I used to do when I was ski instructing. If you can teach somebody to ski in a day, you can teach somebody to photograph in a day. So I sort of use that analogy quite a lot with people.
Right. Tell me a little bit more about your guiding, because I think it's fair to say it's probably a relatively new thing that people are coming out and using a guide, because I think one of the reasons probably is these days that in order to see wildlife, if you don't know what you're doing. And I count myself as one of the people who does not know what he's doing. It takes a lot of time and a lot of learning. But if you can go with someone who knows what they're doing, actually, you know, in an era where people tend to be cash rich and time poor, that actually helps you enormously. What sort of things do you do with your clients?
So I stick to just Scotland. I don't do any international trips at all. Mm-hmm. And I stick to areas that I've been working for years so that I have an intimate knowledge of what species are there and also the locations, where the light's good at certain times of the day, and also where individuals are. Now, I'll talk a little bit about that later on. But there's, in this industry that I'm in, I came into it with open eyes that guiding and workshops and tours were going to make up quite a sizable portion of the business. I used to manage a garden centre, and that was a multifaceted business. It had a restaurant, it had a plant area, it had a gift shop, it had a food hall, it had a florist's. My business is like the garden centre. It's multifaceted. So, I've got the books. I sell prints. I do commissions. I write articles. I write books. So you spread your risk then a little bit more. So when I decided to leave the garden centre and commit to becoming full time at what I do, it was on the proviso that I was going to be doing a lot of tours and workshops, which I love doing. I love teaching people, and I get a real buzz from seeing people's expressions on their faces when they've had an otter curl up and fall asleep 20 feet in front of them. we've been there, or the otter's been rolling about. I have quite regularly have clients in tears, not because I swear at them or shout at them, but the opposite. it's a reaction to the emotion of being that close to a wild animal, a beautiful wild animal doing amazing things. Yes. But in this industry, there's three different types of people that do what I do. There's what I class as the old school photographers, people that I respect and have encouraged me over the years, people that we've been doing it for 20, 30 years. Their business model changed from stock photography, where they were making a great living in the 70s, 80s and 90s. And then suddenly, as Getty Images came in and bought all the photo libraries, the market just fell out of them. So these guys have had to adapt to doing tours and workshops. And I think I'm not speaking out of turn when I say that the majority of those guys don't really want to do tours and workshops if they've had to do it.
Yeah.
The second type are, in my humble opinion, are quite dangerous types of photography guides, because they're the semi-professional ones, the guys that work full-time in well-paid jobs and then will work on the side for international photography companies, and they'll go to Africa with their clients as a leader of a trip under the umbrella of a different company, under one of the big wildlife photography companies. They're not interested in their clients' pictures. They're getting a subsidized free holiday, basically. And you as a client are paying for their holiday. Those guys, to me, are a bit dangerous, because they're not, as I say, they will always be in the best position. They'll always get the best shot, and they won't really care for their clients. Mm-hmm. Then you've got guys like me that have come into this industry quite late on, quite recently, with an open mind that clients are our, financial future. And I really try to look after my clients as best I can. You know, they're in the best spots. I sometimes take a camera with me as well, and I take pictures when I'm with clients, but I can guarantee you my clients will be in the best position. Mm-hmm. And for us, because we haven't been forced into it, we're happy to do it. And it's, for me, it's a joy. And I think it's testament that the majority of my clients return time and time again. I have one client who's been on 14 or 15 trips with me. I've got multiple clients that are now into their sort of 8, 10, 12 trips with me. So, and they repeat the same trips year on year. So they know that they're going to get different light and different experiences each year that they come with me. And they want to get better at what they're getting as well. I'm delighted when clients win competitions, and some of them have won sort of national competitions with pictures that they've taken with my guidance. So, it's a nice rosette to wear, when your clients get, recognition for the pictures that they've taken while you've guided them and facilitated it, so that's good.
So you see these people, you think, oh, there's one of mine there.
I can recognize it. Yeah. And the amazing thing is, when I even look at clients' pictures, I'm instantly transported mentally back to that situation. And I can remember the build up to it. I can remember what happened afterwards. and that blows their mind that, 5 years ago, I can remember exact location we were when that picture was taken. But that's a lot to do with being in the zone, you know, in inverted commas. When things go well, it's absolutely branded into your mind and into your memory bank. You know, these are quite high emotion encounters.
Oh, absolutely! I've no doubt about that. Absolutely, I went over to, you probably know, James Roddy. You know, you'll know James, I'm sure.
James is a good lad. He's one of my sort of camp of coming into it with open eyes, and so he's a good guide as well.
Well, I went and spent a very, very cold evening in his Pine Martin hide in the Black Isle. But was rewarded by just an incredible sighting of a Pine Martin, far closer than I would ever have got in my life, really. There is something very special about sharing a space with a wild animal like that, that is totally untamed, totally at home in its own environment, and sort of allows you to be there.
It's a special moment, that's for sure. Yeah,
it is. Now, okay, let's go back a little bit to what you were saying about otters. You know, is it just still photography you take, or do you also take films?
The thing is, John, about otters is they're so dynamic in their characteristics. They very rarely sit still. They're wriggly little things. And I quite often film them. And I've just uploaded a video to YouTube Andy Howard Nature Photography is the page, and then it's called The Secret Life of the Otter, same title as the book. It's a 23-minute documentary I made about otters, and a friend of mine, that Phil James, who's a composer and musician with the Royal Shakespeare Company in Stratford, composed 3 bits of music for me.
Oh, wow, that's incredible.
And I tried to make it as professional as possible. It's very much an amateur effort because I'm not a wildlife filmmaker. And but in that film, there is some quite special moments with otters, not only them catching fish and rolling about and being very cute and that type of thing. There's some footage of 2 otters courting where the female gets all excited by the male being around, and then the male starts getting all frisky with the seaweed that she's been lying on. Then the next sequence of shots is 2 otters mating. Then we've got 3 otters and 2 seagulls in the one frame, and there's a bit of interaction between the eagles and the otters. I'll not spoil what happens, but in the end sequence, there's a cub suckling from its mum. And some of these shots that I've got are with otters, like with the mountain hares, I've got to know personally. And you know, once you sort of find out what species are in an area, like we talked about earlier, you then get to know the individuals that live in that small area. And it's finding out which mountain hare, which squirrel, which otter, which pine martin, which ones are the ones that you can work with as a photographer, and which ones are maybe slightly more relaxed and a bit more friendly. They're like humans, you know, we're mammals, and some of us are more friendly than others. You know, as you can tell, I could chat for Britain. But some of the otters are definitely a bit more receptive to the presence of a human. Ideally with otters, you don't want them to know that you're there. But some of them will be a little bit more relaxed with the smell of a human, you know, or the sound of a camera shutter. So the film is packed full of, you know, encounters that I've had with otters, and it's nice to see them moving and living, being living creatures rather than just stills.
Yeah, because they're very much, they're very much creatures of movement, really, aren't they? They live in a moving environment. They're full of life and movement. So yeah, that's really important to be able to capture them.
For me, photography is a funny thing because it's technology. With the hardware of the computer chips in it, things like that, and the power drives and the batteries, that's technology. You've also then got the science of how the light refracts on the lenses and how that affects the backgrounds. If you want those sparkles in the background, you have to know the technical element to photography. But the third and the most important element of photography in general, not just wildlife photography, is the artistic side. And this is where your formative years as a photographer, so if you are getting into photography, the formative years are learning the technical and the technological side of photography. Once you get that out of the way and you master that, then your artistic juices start flowing. That's when you can add, you know, the orange sunset background, the sparkles in behind an otter or a puffin, and you know, choosing your backgrounds and creating art through photography. And it's very difficult to convey emotion through photography, but it's something which I like to think that I can do with my photography, and it hopefully comes through. Certainly the feedback I get from readers and people on social media is that they can feel that emotion through images, and that to me is vitally important.
Andy, that's been fascinating. It's lovely to hear that you have an obvious passion for what you do, and I'm sure that comes through not only in your work, in your writing, and in your teaching as well. Been really fascinating talking to you. I'll put links to your books and links to your video on the podcast page, so if you've been listening to this, you'd like to see examples of Andy's work and maybe have a look at his books, you can follow the links on the podcast site. Andy, fascinating. Lovely to talk to you. Thanks very much for your time, and I hope to speak to you again.
Thanks, John. It's been a pleasure, and thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Okay. Take care.
Bye-bye.